Glad to have you all with us for the beginning of another week on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Big week coming up in Georgia. Not only do we imagine that there will be ongoing protests in Atlanta, Metro Atlanta, and perhaps across the state of Georgia over police violence, but of course, tomorrow is the long delayed election day. Finally, it arrives June 9th. We're going to spend an awful lot of the show today talking about the election and sharing with you information about the balloting, who's on the ballots, what races we're kind of paying attention to. And I do that with a caution to a lot of you who know that over the past weeks, we've focused a great deal of our attention on this show on first coronavirus, which has been obviously one of the biggest stories that any of us who are journalists will cover in our lifetimes. And then, of course, when the death of George Floyd, the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery took place down in Glynn County, we shifted focus to spend an awful lot of time on that event. And at the same time, our core mission has always been to share with you smart, respectful, and analysis about politics. And so today we're going to do a lot of that on the show. The panel today, Jim Galloway, he's my partner from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on Monday and Friday shows. Jim, lead political writer for the AJC. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the newspaper itself, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. And Jim, we just saw the jolt, which is a roundup of the political news that you, Greg Bluestein, Tia Mitchell, gather and share with us. How are you doing today?
Oh, we're doing fine. We were already leading with a bit of news on Keisha Lance Bottoms, mayor of Atlanta, and just within the last few minutes, Politico is reporting that she is indeed on Joe Biden's list of a vetting list for vice president, which is it's interesting.
We'll get into that in a few minutes on the show because it is fascinating. Lori Geary is back with us today, and we're glad to have you back, Lori. Lori, of course, longtime political reporter for WSB-TV in Atlanta, now has her own communications company, Lori Geary Media, but for our purposes, even more important, the host of Georgia Gang, which airs on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on Fox 5. Lori, I think I'm right. It's not only the longest running political show in television. I don't think there's any show that's been on the air longer than Georgia Gang, is there?
I don't think so. I know it's more than 30 years, so that's a big feat.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know it's more than 30 years because back in the old days, we used to air that show at Channel 2 at WSB-TV, and I was one of the panelists on that show, and that was 30-plus years ago. Right. Anyhow, Lori, I'm awfully glad you're back with us today.
Nice to be back. Thanks, Bill.
We're also joined today by Amy Steigerwalt, Dr. Amy Steigerwalt, a professor of political science at Georgia State University. How are you doing, Amy?
We're doing well, getting ready for a bit of hot weather there and also to see what happens in the long-awaited primary.
Yeah, I also got a chance to overhear you and our other panelists today, Karen Owen, political science professor at West Georgia University, talk a little bit about trying to figure out now that the Board of Regents, the chancellor has said, yes, state universities are going to be open, Karen, you're not quite sure how that's all going to look, are you?
Yes.
I'm sorry, University of West Georgia. What did I say?
Oh, I think you said West Georgia University. It's okay. University of West Georgia. So I think, like Amy and I were just talking briefly before the show, it's just learning exactly what classes will look like in the fall. How will we get the students in? Will we be wearing masks? How will we be monitoring? It's going to be a different fall, for sure.
I think it's going to be a different fall for most of us. So, welcome to the club. All right, let's get going. First of all, just a couple notes about the weekend activity in Metro Atlanta, at least. It's interesting, Jim Galloway, that Mayor Bottoms, two nights in a row, Saturday night and Sunday night, lifted the curfew that she'd put in place for all of last week because the demonstrations by this weekend, despite the fact there were continuing to be big crowds who showed up in a couple of different locations in the city, they were all peaceful. And so Jim, the mayor, was able to say, we don't need the curfew anymore, and we'll have to wait and see how she handles that in this week ahead. But Jim, that's a good sign.
Right. It's a good sign, and it, because it really threatened Tuesday voting. I mean, she issued an order late on Friday ordering the APD not to enforce the curfew at voting precincts, where we know there was a long line that stretched beyond midnight for many people in Fulton County. So this was a good sign. It was, you know, it was interesting, Bill. I mean, we the weekend saw demonstrations in what we would normally call very Republican sections of Metro Atlanta. We had them in Forsyth County. I had them way out here in West Cobb County, which has been a Republican bastion. So it's quite a thing to see how widely they're spread and where people are getting involved.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. As Jim points out, smaller communities in Georgia have been having protests. My own neighborhood here in DeKalb County, there was a demonstration. Just a few blocks away from us, a gathering of people, neighbors in the community who came out holding up protest signs, calling for racial equality, calling for an end to racism. And we've seen across the country similar things happening, Lori. Small towns having protests too, which is one reason some people feel we really have reached an inflection point. Lori?
I think so. I think now we're back to the message of the true meaning of these protests, and it's refreshing to see. I know my kids' school actually put out, a letter to parents saying, hey, here are three areas we think if you want to go protest, we're comfortable enough recommending you should go here. And I think one of them was Phipps Plaza. So I think it was great to see the lifting of the curfew because I feel like we're heading in the right direction now. And I know a lot of the Atlanta businesses, the restaurants and bars that were able to open once again, I was getting emails and texts, hey, we're open. So I think, you know, the city is healing slowly from what happened last weekend.
I think that's a great way to put it. And I think it's also sort of recognizing where the efforts are going and that it's a real issue that there needs to be not only a local but a national reckoning with. And I think we're finally starting to also see that dialogue truly happening of saying, what is it that we have been doing as a city, as a country, as a locality, and how do we fix it, right? We're not okay actually with the status quo. It's not simply about, you know, are there not protests? Are there not riots? It's more of what actually do we need to potentially change and be both deliberate and also think through the long-term implications so that we can perhaps not repeat this? Because I think what a lot of us have seen is that there's a lot of echoes of 1965, 1968, that we thought we wouldn't see again in this country, and we are. So how do we ensure that we don't see that again in 2040 or something like that?
Yes. Yeah, so, Lori makes a great point about how it does look as if the protests and the demonstrations are going back to the real core mission here. And that is important for all of us to look at because that message will now come through. And I think the small, Amy hits the point too that, the local communities will be starting to see that solidarity coming together, understanding how to move to the next step. And I think one way that we can see moving to the next step here in Georgia will be tomorrow in the primaries and how many people will take the action, the thoughts that they had from these protests and demonstrations and mobilize and use that to go vote to seek change.
You know, Bill, We've got a line. You can find it in the Jolt, but Mark Nisi with the AJC has something out on the makeup of voters who have already cast their ballots. And what he picked up on was a big surge in African American voters following May 25th, Memorial Day. The line is turnout rose every day last week, especially among Black voters, who accounted for 44% of all in-person votes on Friday. They only make 30% of all balloting. Now, you know, some of it may be anger about George Floyd. Some of it may be just angst about the turmoil in Fulton County regarding absentee ballots. But still, I think that's a pretty huge leap right there.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing that we're seeing such a big participation across all lines already, but particularly seeing the African-American turnout, Jim, because as we know in the past, particularly African-American men have been underrepresented at the ballot box, yes?
Absolutely, absolutely. And young people. Both are concerns. If you're a Democrat, you're concerned about both of those, and these protests seem to be reaching into those both of those groups.
I want to talk just a couple
more
minutes.
In a way that Joe Biden can't. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. We'll talk about that in a couple minutes. Before we get off the protest completely, I do want to point out one other thing that. Protests were peaceful this weekend. There were about 100 protesters who gathered downtown at the state capitol. They wanted to tear down a statue of John Brown Gordon, who, by the way, is posed in this statue in his full Confederate uniform. He was a Georgia governor back in the late 19th century. He was a Confederate war commander, and he may have been one of the leaders of the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia. So, you know, the fact that there were protesters saying they might want to tear down that statue, it is understandable that there would be some efforts to protect the Capitol grounds with National Guard and police. But Jim, I know you want to get in, so I'm going to let you in a second. I also, though, got a note from a young woman who was at the governor's mansion on West Paces Ferry last night, who said there were about 50, 60, maybe 75 people there, and there was a huge contingent of National Guard troops. There was military equipment in the streets, and she was very frightened by what she thought was an inappropriately heavy response to a peaceful march. But go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, look, the state has been far more quick to bring in military garbed police, both at the governor's mansion and at the state capitol. What I wanted to point out about the John Brown Gordon statue is that it was erected in 1907. And the timing there is very, very important, because 1906 is when the Atlanta race riot hit. When you had dozens of African Americans killed by white rioters, there was much property damage then too. By the way,
all right, let's talk about the election coming up tomorrow. But I think the way we need to frame this, Amy, let me start with you, if I might, is to point out that there are some significant concerns, particularly in Atlanta, in Fulton County, about early voting, about how they handled absentee balloting, and how they're going to handle the primary election tomorrow. I got emails, and of course the news reported a lot of this. I got emails from listeners. One listener told me that on Friday she waited to vote at her Fulton County polling place for 8+ hours to cast her ballot, and she was far from alone. As Galloway pointed out a little while ago, there were people who waited till midnight to early vote. And then we also have this problem where Fulton County has not been able to maintain control over the absentee ballots that they set out. They're still missing returns, and according to the Secretary of State's office, those ballots have to be counted and in by 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Amy, are we facing a real mess as people show up to vote tomorrow?
Potentially. There's a lot of concerns. Now, one of the big issues, particularly in Fulton, is that there were only 8 early voting sites. There will be 160 open for tomorrow. So conceivably, that should, at least for those who want to go out and vote in person, solve some of those issues. Cobb County also was reporting polling lines that were stretching to 3, 4, 5 hours. So we were seeing this a lot because I think that sort of, as you mentioned near the top of the show, we are seeing a very large uptick in political participation. I know a lot of my students were talking about how I think it was the Alabama football team all met up and then did sort of their own protest march and then went and all registered to vote for their things. And I think we're seeing that in a lot of other places. And so that could conceivably handle that. The bigger issue, which I think we could also run into, is how to handle these the people who had requested absentee ballots and are saying that they still haven't received them. So what is going to happen to the person who requested that? Does that mean that they need to go now show up at the polls? If they do show up at the polls, is there going to be some concern that they've tried to vote twice? Or where is that counting coming in? And so I think that there are a lot of concerns, and it's definitely something that's going to have to be thought through towards November as we try to figure out what it's going to look like, especially if there's a concern about a second wave.
So Amy has made a good point about how we've seen an uptick in interest of people wanting to turn out to vote. But two things I want to, you know, think about and remind. Yes, there were fewer polling places open for early voting in a lot of counties right now because they didn't have enough poll workers, because a lot of the poll workers were in that vulnerable group over 65 that could not help and volunteer, you know, to work the polls. And then the second piece of that is we do have new voting machines in Georgia. So, you know, some of the time may be that some voters were having to learn that new voting apparatus and how to actually cast the ballot. So, I mean, I think we have to consider all of the complexity that's gone on in early voting. And hopefully, you know, tomorrow when the lines, when there are more polls open, it will go a little bit smoother for everyone there.
I think at the very least, I think Fulton County is going to have to look at extending the voting times, you know, until 9 p.m. I know that was a thought that was put out there. I also think, you know, one, it's going to be a mess, I think, voting tomorrow. But two, the tally and the counting of these votes, I don't think we're going to have any inclination of, you know, who's winning in some of these major races that involve Fulton County for a long time. But we've seen this before. So imagine on top of all of this, the pandemic, and then the numbers of voting coming out for a primary. Remember, it's a primary. I think it's going to be maybe into Wednesday, maybe Thursday before we see any real results.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jim.
The good news, Bill, is that you got 159 election offices who were given authority to start counting absentee ballots last Monday on June 1st. So the wait might not be as long as we think. Fulton County still concerns me. I mean, over the weekend they put out a call for 250 volunteers, immediate volunteers. I mean, a last minute bid to help man these polling stations. That doesn't bode well either.
Yeah, I mean, that's a significant red flag, Jim. Yeah, Jim, you know, it isn't as if this is the first time. It isn't as if we're suddenly saying, oh, wow, how unusual. Fulton County is having a problem with an election. This is a persistent, ongoing theme in the county. Rob Pitts, the chairman, expressed a lot of frustration. Nakima Williams, the state chair of the Democratic Party, complained that this is Republicans who simply, you know, who control the election apparatus. They don't really care. They just sort of shrug these things off. However you look at it, Jim, Fulton County they just haven't gotten their act together.
No. Two things. Number one, it has more voters than any other county in the state. It is also a county that has really been disassembled. via the municipal movement of the last 10-15 years. And remember, the other part of this is that we've got this discombobulated election system where the Secretary of State officially oversees all these activities, but not really. You've got these election offices with and election boards at the local county level with a tremendous amount of independence and so responsibility.
Hey, I got all right. Let's do this. Why don't we take our first break of the show now? Get that out of the way. Come back. I want to talk for a couple minutes. Jim Galloway, you already mentioned Keisha Lance Bottom suddenly rising in the Biden campaign's assessment of possible vice presidential running mates. I want to talk a little bit about that. But then with the panel, I'd love to just go over some of the most important races and share with our listeners information that, if they haven't voted yet, may help them unravel what they've got to deal with when they go to their polling places tomorrow. We'll do that after these messages. This is Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Amy Steigerwalt, Karen Owen, Lori Geary joining me for today's show. Lori, Mayor Bottoms got national acclaim last week when on Friday night she made impromptu remarks as she watched vandals, looters, clashes with police unfold on the streets of downtown Atlanta. And she won the praise of many, many people because she spoke from the heart as a mother who has a son who she's very, very concerned about. And we all thought, Lori, that this, along with the way she's been handling the pandemic, could in fact give her a higher profile in terms of being a possible running mate for Joe Biden. And now Galloway's already informed us, Politico confirms she's absolutely on that list. Lori?
Yes, I think politics, as you know, is all about timing, right? And I think a lot of us thought she was on the list, but she was a little bit lower down on the list. I think this week she took the spotlight away from Stacey Abrams, for sure. She was put in this national spotlight. Perhaps a lot of people didn't know about her, but that speech, it was a speech for the time. It was a speech that connected with so many different voters. And I just think that she's being vetted doesn't surprise me at all. I just think that, you know, she moved up quite a few notches because I think she's who a lot of the she's what the Democrats need, I think, right now in terms of, you know, this healing that we're talking about. I just thought it was such a great speech. And also, you know, you have to remember, she was one of the first out of the gate to support Joe Biden, to support the former vice president. So I know that loyalty means a lot in politics as well.
The Washington Post this weekend, Karen, I'm just reading this now in the Jolt, has an article about the, they've rated the potential running mates, put them in a numerical order. And Karen, according to the Post assessment, Mayor Bottoms is place number 7 on the list, ahead, by the way, of Stacey Abrams by one place. But here's what it says. The 50-year-old Atlanta mayor has impressed Democrats far and wide with both her handling of the unrest in Atlanta and, importantly, her public appearances. She was also one of Biden's earliest endorsers and has served as a surrogate for his campaign. Lori just told us that. And then they go on to say, but being a mayor of a big city doesn't always translate well to running for higher office, given the many difficult local decisions for which you can be held accountable and which may not have been previously unearthed. Karen, that's an interesting take on this.
Right. And I think we talked last week when I was on the show about how Mayor Bottoms had done a great job in kind of walking that great line between showing her femininity and her compassion and being a real spokesperson from the heart, as well as showing decisive, strong action when she needed to fire or get involved and help the police chief with the firing of the two officers. And I think on the national stage, yes, she's definitely risen and gotten attention. And Joe Biden obviously likes her because they stumped together somewhat in South Carolina when he was working on the primary there. But I think when it becomes down to selection, the Biden campaign has to think about who is ready to work with him at the national level. And of course, the Democrats don't want to bring someone on who could drag down the ticket in any way or get caught in the national limelight and can't handle a certain issue.
I think it's interesting, Jim, though, that, and again, let me get to you, and then Amy, I'll come to you after this. I'm sorry. Jim, so in the Joel today, there's a quote from State Senator Nikema Williams. I mentioned earlier, she's the Democratic Party chair in Georgia. Imposing a curfew, speaking about Mayor Bottoms, sent a message that silenced the voice of the people. I'm glad the mayor corrected course to listen to Atlantans calling for change. This is only a first step. Now it's time for Atlanta, Georgia, and the rest of the country to take real action to end the police brutality that disproportionately plagues Black people and put our community first. So it's interesting that there's that quote, which kind of proves the point that the Washington Post makes about when you're a mayor, you're held accountable for a lot of little decisions that people suddenly will be looking at closely.
Right, right. And I mean, a mayor is a chief executive. And it's interesting. What Bottoms' remarks kind of have turned up is this very interesting division between African American, the Atlanta's African American middle class and its African American lower class. And I think that's what both Nikema was speaking to, and that's what Vincent Fort further down in the Jolt is also addresses. And remember, we have just been through a very hot primary in which a mayor of South Bend, Indiana, had to pay a price for some of the decisions he'd made on racial issues within his police force.
Amy, I didn't mean to cut you off. Please go ahead.
Oh no, totally fine. Everyone has covered this in a fantastic way. And I just to sort of piggyback on what has already been said is that one of the things that I think that really brings to light is, in some ways, right, when you are the chief executive of whatever the entity is, all of the decisions that are made within that area can conceivably be tied back to you. And so the issues that sort of potentially face Bottoms in running or getting the VP nod are it has the possibility to re-bring up sort of all of the things that we saw being debated last year, for example, in the legislature over the handling of contracting at Atlanta-Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, of discussions of what's going to be happening, right? Obviously, and even how the protests were handled, how when there was violence that broke out, how that was handled, other issues that are still ongoing, such as the different indictments that were brought against the previous administration. So even though Mayor Bottoms wasn't a part of that, it still sort of carries over of the issues that come of having been a chief executive in Atlanta, and that is an issue. Now, on the other hand, though, all candidates in many ways are going to have some other issues that are come up for that. So, for example, right, other people that are being talked about are Senator Kamala Harris and the fact that she used to be Attorney General of California and decisions that were made while she was Attorney General there. Same thing with Amy Klobuchar and decisions that were made when she was a district attorney. And so there's always going to be potential pitfalls, and it's a question of sort of what exactly what you're okay with, right, in having in a candidate, and also what you are sort of using your vice presidential candidate to signal and to whom you're trying to signal to particularly.
Okay, so the decision that Joe Biden will make about his running mate is still likely to be weeks away. What's not weeks away is all the people who have to vote tomorrow or plan to vote, want to vote in the primary election. Let's go through some of the races that are going to be on many people's ballots. Lori, if people take a Democratic ballot tomorrow, certainly they'll vote for president. Joe Biden is already now secured the Democratic nomination, so that vote You'll get a chance to vote for I don't even know how many Democrats are on that ballot, to tell you the truth. But Biden obviously has already secured the nomination. The next big race, of course, Lori, is the race for the U.S. Senate, the opportunity to replace David Perdue, to run against David Perdue. That's what you'll face if you're a Democrat. Talk to us about the three main contenders, Lori.
Right. And just a reminder, because I keep getting it on the Georgia gang bill that, you know, the Kelly Loeffler race will not be on the ballot because, you know, that will be decided in November. But you're looking at the three top Democrats in the David Perdue race. You have John Ossoff, who is the leader at this point, according to all of the polls, sometimes in double digits. You have, and, you know, he ran against Karen Handel for the 6th congressional and lost, but, you know, that was the highest profile and probably the most expensive race in history, congressional race in history. Then you have Teresa Tomlinson, who is the Columbus mayor, who has, I think, waged a really good fight. She's gone against her opponent, John Ossoff, and I think in a way that didn't divide the party in this race. And then you have Sarah Riggs Amico, who ran for lieutenant governor the previous round. So those are your three top leading Democrats to round it off.
Jim, Ossoff has had John Lewis's endorsement, and that probably has helped him, I assume, with African-American voters. And yesterday, Ossoff spent a good part of Sunday walking with African-American churchgoers and leaders to the Capitol. So it'll be interesting to see what that does in terms of how this race moves forward, Jim.
He's got an interesting number one. He's got the money to be on TV a good amount, and so far his most effective ad has been a reference to the Ahmaud Arbery slang back in February as a local corruption issue. Tomlinson, as you mentioned, Ossoff has John Lewis behind him. Tomlinson has Andy Young, Augusta Mayor Hardy Davis, quite a few, a very long list of current and active civil rights leaders. So it's going to be interesting to see how her kind of under the radar campaign turns out, whether she can keep. I think right now at this stage her object is to keep Ossoff under 50% and draw him into an August 11 runoff.
Karen, everybody on the ballot tomorrow, without exception, is suffering from a lack of exposure, given that the state's eyes have been focused on first coronavirus and then on what's been happening in the streets of cities across Georgia. So presumably, John Ossoff, who established name recognition during his race against Karen Handel, it has an advantage because Tomlinson, she has had an enormous number of civil rights endorsements, as Jim points out, and Amico, they've had a longer road to hoe to make themselves known to the state's voters, Karen.
Well, yes, Ossoff does have high name recognition from the 6th District race, and he had we talked about that was the most expensive race, so he had a lot of national exposure and attention. But I think you're right. This has been a difficult primary season where candidates can't go to retail politics. They can't go out and meet with voters, which I think would be a very strong asset for Teresa Tomlinson, because that was part of her ground game, which was to get out to voters across the state and show that she could appeal to a lot of Democrats around the state, not just Metro Atlanta. I think right now, having lived right here in the Metro Atlanta, I see all the different advertisements on TV, and you wonder if those messages are getting through her ads or Amico. And interesting about Sarah Riggs Amico is she was the one who has run statewide. Just 2 years ago, she was running for lieutenant governor, so she should have relatively high name recognition. So I think it will be really a deciding factor if the candidates the two women can keep Ossoff below that 50%, and then who will actually be in a runoff with him. And he learned in the 6th District that even though you go into a runoff with the lead, doesn't mean that you can actually win the runoff.
Those are excellent points that Amy? Karen brought up. And I think one of the other issues that comes into it is that in some sense that because a lot of the reporters, because a lot of the national attention sort of already knew the Ossoff name when he decided to get into the race, which was actually after, well after really, Teresa Tomlinson and Sarah Riggs-Amico, that sort of bumped it up. The other side of it is work actually that Karen has done and others shows that there is sort of this different coverage that you see of male contenders versus female contenders, that there is more attention given to their sort of policy platforms, whereas women a lot of times are covered more as to their characteristics. And so you actually do really sort of see that a lot on Teresa Tomlinson. I think she's had a really battled to say, hey, look, I was mayor of Columbus and did a lot. I've held elective office. I held elective office for a long time. I've got this strong thing, but there's a lot more of people talking about her kind of genteel nature and the way that she'll go about things and do compromise in a way that sort of Ossoff isn't being asked to try to provide. He hasn't held elective office. He ran in a race which got a lot of attention, but as an actual elected official, he doesn't have that background there. And so it's interesting to kind of watch how it's gotten played and sort of where people's attentions have gone and who's been willing to go into which camp. But I think the biggest issue here is going to be that we're very likely, as Karen noted, to have a runoff, right? And that's at this point what's really happening. And I think once we get to that runoff, that will be important because theoretically, because all of the also COVID restrictions are being released, the candidates will be able to go back to that much more personal retail type of campaigning, which, as Karen pointed out, Teresa Tomlinson is very good at.
So, Jim Galloway, we should very quickly point out that if you're taking a Republican ballot tomorrow, the Senate, the one Senate race, I'm glad Lori reminded everybody, we don't get to vote for Kelly Loeffler or one of the other candidates, Republican or Democrats, until November in Senate race number two. But Jim, David Perdue is the incumbent, of course, and he'd like your vote, obviously, because the more votes he can put together, the stronger case he can make for how much support he has across the state. So that's what happens in that Senate race number one. There are like seven, a total of seven, by the way, Democrats on the Democratic side of that Senate race. But Jim, let's talk about especially the 7th District congressional race, because there both Democrats and Republicans have a pretty healthy list of candidates to choose among. Help us with that one.
Okay, all right. First of all, let us just simply say this race, the 7th District race, is not going to end on Tuesday. It will definitely go on, right? Both sides will go to a runoff. All right, you have on the Republican side, you have Rich McCormick. You have he's a doctor. He's been playing up the COVID-19 angle quite a bit. You've got Renee Unterman, the former state senator, who is the who carried HB 481, the anti-abortion bill, that's now all on hold. Those are probably the two people who are going to make it. There are quite a few others. It's a little bit more dicey on the Democratic side. You've got Carolyn Bordeaux, who came so close to beating Rob Woodall in 2018. Then you've got Zarak Karinchik, a state senator who just got elected to the state senate in 18, was expected to run for re-election, and has decided to make that leap upward, kind of like Lucy McBath did in 2018. And you've got a number of you've got Brenda Lopez,
Nabila Islam,
Yeah, Nabila, yeah. Islam. Those are. You know, I would say those are. If they get into a runoff, I would consider both of those kind of upset candidates, upset performances. The thing is, you've got in Gwinnett County. This is the 7th district is primarily Gwinnett, but also a good slice of Forsyth. Which has been pretty conservative, but there are signs of Democratic influence spreading even there. You've got all these new Democratic networks setting up, and we don't know exactly where that's going. Because remember, at this time you've also got a race for chairman of the Cobb for the Gwinnett County Commission and a sheriff's race. And both of those are very, very those are network intensive races right there, both of them.
Lori, if we go to the Republican side of that 7th district race, the battle between McCormick and Renee Unterman has been fierce, just unbelievably fierce. And a group that's been supporting him has put out some thoroughly offensive material about Renee Unterman. It'll be interesting to see if that shapes the voters' decisions in any way.
It'll be interesting to see if that shakes the female voters, Bill, because I think those were so offensive. You know, showing Renee Unterman, and I'm not tying this to Rich McCormick at all, but just, you know, these anonymous mailers that were showing Renee Unterman in a straitjacket when we know she's been public about her battles with depression. So I'm interested to see how that will happen, because Senator Renee Unterman also has such a high profile in this district. I mean, she has been fighting for things like, you know, the anti-sex trafficking issues. She's been high profile on the abortion bill as well. But, you know, this is such an interesting race because this district has not gone Democrat since, like, the 1990s, right? And so I think there'll be so many eyes on it to see who winds up in the Democratic runoff along with the Republican runoff. You know, and this is now a minority district. It went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, then Stacey Abrams 2 years later. So I think, you know, we're seeing where the direction of this district is going.
Yes, and Amy? I would say that if you sort of starting on the Democratic side, on some level, Carolyn Bordeaux did enter this race with a bit of a head start, given that she had spent the 2 years previous already running for this district. So she had run within the district, had set up a very strong network within there, both in terms of fundraising and campaigning. And I think we're seeing that. So she is also really winning on the fundraising side, and that's going to help her, particularly if it does go to a runoff. On the Republican side, what's been really interesting, I think, is to look at the endorsements. And one of the big differences is that most of McCormick's endorsements are coming actually from out of state. So the Club for Growth, Representative Jim Jordan, whereas Renee Unterman has gotten really a lot of endorsements from the local Georgia leadership, former Governor Nathan Deal, the current Lieutenant Governor, et cetera. And so I think that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and how it affects voters at the polls tomorrow.
So I would like to add here on the 7th that this is part of what we in political science love to see, right? These open seat contests where lots of candidates jump in. And on the Democratic side, you definitely see at the top where three women are making an active push to gain the Democratic nomination. And then on the Republican side, as Amy and others have already mentioned, with the two candidates and how, you know, this will be a test of Republican primary activists if they are ready to make a change for the party and put a woman as their nominee in a congressional race like they did in the 6th district, and then have where you would see a female versus a female contest in the general, and then how that dynamic will play out, or if, you know, Republican Party activists in Gwinnett are going to be, you know, hearing the message from the national Republicans and seeing candidates that they think will be able to sit at the seat in Congress. I think that's part of the dynamic we have to also look at when we look at the results at the end of tomorrow or Wednesday.
Right. Jim, we're going to have to take a break in a second, but just to let's flesh out a couple quick things here before we do. Number one, there are competitive Republican on the Republican ballot, competitive races to fill seats of incumbents in the retiring congressman in the 9th and the 14th. Those are largely going to be Republican contests. Those are pretty safe Republican districts. And in the 6th, we're pretty certain that Karen Handel is likely to win that race. The question is who on the and she'll face Lucy McBeth on the Democratic side. So if you want to expand on that briefly before I take a break, please do.
Yeah, there are several other candidates in that primary, and I wouldn't want to rule them out. But if I were going to put money on any particular congressional race that's going to escape a runoff in Georgia, that would be it.
Okay. Let's do this. Let's get to our final break of the show. And when we come back, just talk about a couple of the races. And then Jim Galloway has some news for us about the Republican National Convention. You're listening to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, you've got a little bit of news about the Republican National Committee you can share with us.
Yeah, this comes via our friend Mr. Greg Bluestein, and you can learn more on AJC.com, but it looks like you're going to have a delegation from the Republican National Committee take a tour of Savannah on Monday, or today, to see if there's a place for an offshoot of the Charlotte Convention in August. Basically, the Republicans have found out they're contractually tied to Charlottesville for so much of that convention, and the current talk is maybe to have Donald Trump give his acceptance speech somewhere where social distancing might not apply. Now, and this is the biggest facility is probably Hutchinson Island. There's a convention center there. State Republicans have had their convention there many times.
Lori, we should point out that conventions are usually planned about 4 years ahead. Site selection committees start looking at cities 4 years ahead of time. President Trump is accelerating that schedule just a bit for their late August convention. Lori?
This will put some event planners back in work rather quickly. It's just amazing to me that they could pull this off. And looking at a place like Savannah and not a huge metropolitan area is interesting as well.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the mayor of Savannah, Van Johnson, a Democrat who's been very strong in believing in coronavirus shelter-in-place rules, will have to say about Savannah and what kind of impediment he might put in place in terms of that. All right, real quickly, we have very little time. Jim, are there any legislative primary race? We know that Democrats are going to battle for control of the Georgia House in November, but are there any races in legislative districts that we should watch tomorrow that could have an impact on what happens in November?
Yeah.
We can't get to all of them.
Okay, first one I'd point to is the Brandon Beach Michael Caldwell level. It's on the seat. It's a Senate race on the Republican side, Cherokee and North Fulton. Beach was originally a 6th district candidate. Then Michelle Henson, longtime House member, Democrat in Stone Mountain. She has 3 opponents this time, and that's I'm going to be watching that one.
Okay. So tomorrow's the day for people who have not had a chance to vote yet. By the way, if you did get an absentee ballot and you got it late, as many of you have said you did, I got an email from one listener who said that he and his wife applied for absentee ballots weeks and weeks ago. His finally came in the mail and he was able to send it back. Hers has still not arrived. She's out of town, he says, so she's kind of stuck not being able to cast a ballot. But my point was going to be, if you've gotten a ballot late, check your county to find out where the drop boxes are that you can put them in so you make sure they're going to get counted before election day ends tomorrow at 7 o'clock. That's about it. We're out of time for today's Political Rewind. Karen Owen, Lori Geary, Amy Steigerwald, Jim Galloway, I really appreciate all of you being with me for the show today. Lori Geary, we'll be watching next Sunday morning at 8:30. You should have a pretty good – you may have, and we may on Friday, finally start seeing results of some of the races that are on the ballot tomorrow, the way things are going.
I hope so. I hope we'll have results in earlier, as Jim Galloway pointed out. But I don't think we will in Fulton County. It's just not how it's been, and I don't think it'll change anytime this year.
Yeah. I think it's going to be tough. All right. That's it for Political Rewind today. As I said, we got a big week ahead with the elections, also continuing to follow the protests. The push for racial justice that's going on across the state of Georgia. We haven't talked about the coronavirus, but that is still very much with us. We will do our best to mix all of that up and get it out to you as the week goes on. My thanks to Jesse Neiswanger, Tom Faust, Sam Burmistawes for Man in the Fort there at GPB. I'm Bill Nigut. See you all tomorrow. If you're going to go vote, please stay safe and healthy. Take care.